And we move to the
fifth case.
Case of U.S. versus Siding.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stephen Meyer on behalf of the appellant, Bernard Seidling. This case presents two related but separate issues. The first issue, if the Court agrees with the appellant, obviates the need to address the second issue. The first issue is simply, and in general terms, whether the conduct of Mr. Seidling falls within the reach of 18 U.S.C. 1341. At its core, the facts surrounding Mr. Seidling's conduct involved the filing with small claims courts in the state of Wisconsin false information. That conduct, those facts, bring to mind two things. Number one, the old adage that not every deceit is a federal crime. And number two, the court's observation in Cleveland versus United States, where they observed that at the commencement of their discussion, that Louisiana had a state law that criminalized the filing of the false applications for the video gaming licenses. Now, the argument against the applicability of this particular statute does not rest on the mailings issue. That was not raised below. And as a matter of fact, when Mr. Seidling would file these small claims actions, sometimes he did them in person, but frequently he did them by mail.
But, you know, Mr. Meyer, if the question here is whether the victim of the scheme, or let's put it even more precisely, the person who lost property also has to be the party deceived, strikes me as a difficult position for you to take because, number one, the statute doesn't actually say that. And so the broader view is there is no statutory requirements for this convergence. Secondly, I have trouble looking at the people who were the victims of Mr. Seidling's scheme as people who aren't deprived of a certain amount of property, not the actual liens. I mean, he does this, as far as I can tell, he does it to be cruel and vindictive. You know, he's just trying to hassle them. But it takes them a certain amount of time and resources and energy to extricate themselves from the Nazis tied them into. So I'm not even sure that it's fair to say that they aren't deprived of tangible property as well as whatever peace of mind he was depriving them of. So I don't know. I think you have an uphill battle on a number of grounds. Our Phoenix Bond case is RICO, but we certainly weren't going in your direction there.
Okay. I think you've now laid out three separate issues that I need to address. Your summary of what I would call the convergence issue, in other words, does the representation have to be made directly to the victim, the false representation have to be made directly to the victim, is actually the government's characterization of my position. That's not what was articulated in my brief. And if I can just divert for a second, there is a cleanliness to that principle. In other words, it's easy to apply, it's quick, there's an attraction to it. And as a matter of fact, that attraction, I believe, is what motivated Professor Miles in his law review article, Dupes and Losers and Mail Fraud, to come to that position. But, and it's also where the circuit split is developed, is on that characterization. But the reality is that our position, recognizing perhaps a degree of timidity on my part, and recognizing the point about not being in the statute, that the definition of materiality posited by the defense is one that is intending to influence the purported victim to part with money or have a tendency to do so. And that's not what I would call full convergence. That's not the direct misrepresentation as characterized by the government. It would allow, for example, let's say you have two brothers, one sort of dim, the other one's successful, and the con goes to the dim brother and says, hey, I've got this piece of property, you know, it's a great investment for you, and that is communicated from the dim brother to the successful brother. And the con, knowing full well it will be communicated, that is what our definition covers. It covers, in that case, the unwitting accomplice. It covers the agent. For example, in U.S. v. Richmond, the adjuster who's in on the con with the lawyer. Hey, you know, say the accident happened over here. And the lawyer knows the adjuster is going to communicate that.
So you're covering all those people under the statute.
Well, yes, exactly, under the definition of materiality. Mm-hmm. And what separates Mr. Seidling's case is that there was no communication from the court to the victims. It wouldn't happen.
He
I mean, that's why
at some point, though. I mean,
well, the scam doesn't make any sense because as soon as they do find out, it's void. The judgment's void ab initio.
Well, but they have to go through, and I mean, anybody who's been the victim of one of these things, whether it's identity theft or having their property have inappropriate liens put on it or whatever, people need to go to some effort, and I think it seems that that's what he was trying to inflict on them.
Are you aware that this is a scheme that's been attempted on judges?
Yes. And I knew that's why this would be a difficult position for me to take. However, I will say the following. If someone filed something in federal court, there's a 1001 count, bingo, right away. That's immediate, that could be applied. Similarly here, in the state of Wisconsin, if liens are filed on our circuit court judges or prosecutors, and actually, historically, I was in the district attorney's office when this all first started, when the posse comitatus began to file liens on every member in our office. I didn't own anything.
You're right, thought you were a young man.
Pardon?
I remember it well, though.
Sometimes I feel old, though. I'm sorry. I understand that occurs, and there are methods and laws applicable to deal with it, as there was here. And why the federal government steps in on this case is part of the problem, in my viewpoint. In terms of Bridge versus Phoenix Bond or Phoenix Bond versus Bridge, I note what may be characterized as the typical differentiation. That was a civil RICO statute. What we're talking about is a criminal statute. And the civil RICO statute specifically is directed to be liberally construed and remedial in nature, whereas criminal statute should be grounded in the rule of lenity, especially 1341. Issues in Phoenix were proximate cause and reliance. Those don't come in play in a criminal 1341 action. And what was not addressed were the issues being raised by Mr. Seidling which are materiality and convergence. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I will defer to Mr. Beaugrey.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning. I'm John Beaugrey. I'm the U.S. Attorney up in Madison, and I've handled this case from the start.
Just one of the things that your office is responsible for is defending judges in those types of things, right?
That would be correct. Just jumping to that point right away, and I don't agree that this scam would have been over as soon as these victims found out about it. I think it's clear from Mr. Wojcik's statements. I think it's paragraph 57 of the PSR that this is. Judge Wood has alluded to, this is one big flipping mess when they try to get it out.
Mr. Wojcik, he was your primary witness on the impact on victims?
He came completely unsolicited. He showed up at sentencing and said, I'd like to make a statement. And obviously with Judge Krav allowed that, and he read his statement. What I envisioned could have played out, since I have a long history with Mr. Seidling, is that when you went to him and said, oh, hey, wait, you sued me, and you've got a $5,000 judgment, he might have said, well, you know, give me $2,000. Give me $500. I thought this didn't happen, as far as I know. The other alternative that I said at sentencing that Judge Krab thought about was these are just simply ticking time bombs. They're growing at 12%. I don't know it exists. Leave me out of it. Mr. Wojcik doesn't know it exists. Let's say it's on his property. He goes to sell it or he dies. Somebody's trying to undo this mess. And now we're in this position where, at the very least, you have a settlement that has to be done.
Or if the people for which these liens were filed are trying to sell their real estate.
Exactly. I take it
this Wisconsin statewide registry gets picked up in a title check on the property.
Yes. CCAP, as we call it. Yeah. Is really a great Wisconsin access system. You can find almost everything, civil judgments and whatnot. So if these folks went online, which I know we're supposed to, but...
Or the title companies.
Title companies certainly would, and they would see these judgments.
About 30 seconds to find out what judgments are.
And then when you think you're walking to get your property, you this whole process comes undone.
There have been incidents, which I'm well aware of, in which the clerk has been enjoined from taking these types of liens.
It becomes
which stops it at that point.
In a few of these courts, which is one of the reasons Mr. Seidling ended up mailing a lot of them in. In a few of them, the judges had said to the small claims clerk, "Don't accept anything more," which is why, as you see alleged in the indictment and also in our brief, he used, I think. I'm going to get this wrong. Let's say 10 or so.
Quite a different name, entities and names.
Just any sort of name, just make it up. You know, DVR, BNS, Institute, whatever. I think ultimately what we have here in the defendant's request, as he said again today, is to add something to the definition of materiality and using the words that Mr. Myers used, that the statement must be intended to influence the victim to give up money, which is not what this court's jury instruction says. Let's start with that. The present pattern instruction says, pardon me?
Start with the jury instruction.
Yeah, there we go. The 2012 pattern, so not the 1999 patterns, which I'm partial to because I was on that committee. In 2012, in the defendant's position, it would not be enough if it is capable of influencing the decision of the person to whom it was addressed. The pattern says person in brackets, or victim in brackets. So you could, it at least thinks, it would imply there's a couple of options. Because clearly, these statements were material. They were material to influence the decision of the person, in this case, entities, to whom they were addressed. They were really, really material.
And you mean the courts?
The courts.
Yeah.
And in Cosentino and those other cases, as most of them are, they're to insurance regulators and things like that. But they were really, really material to the courts. Where do you live? Were you served? What was it published in the area where you live? All of which were just outright lies. If you lived in Dane County, Madison, you were sued in Sawyer County up near Lake Superior. It just, there wasn't any way this would work. So they were not only really material to the court, Those lies were the key part of the scheme. The key part of the scheme was to lie to the court and then have the court do something, which the courts did. As with the insurance regulating agencies, you lie to them, they let you keep your insurance agency going, and you keep scamming or stealing money or whatnot. So it was very material to the decision of the recipient, which I believe is all that is required by materiality. They based their decisions on it. It didn't just tend to influence them. It did influence those judges, and they entered their orders. So I don't think the additional element is Judge Wood's question. It's certainly not required by 1341. In 1001 and 1014, Congress knows how to say you have to make a statement to a specific person, a member of the Department of Justice or whatnot, or in 1014 to an insured institution or all those other things. And the statute simply doesn't say that. I also don't think that this extra definition, if you will, is required by any sort of policy. And I know it's part of the brief and just a little bit of Mr. Meyer's argument today that there's some other statutes. Certainly it's a crime to lie to Wisconsin courts. I don't deny that. But this is simply not the sort of overreaching or stretching or pushing some envelope that resulted in McNally.
You know, 40 years ago, we used to say that if we got together and we indicted somebody and mailed them a copy of the indictment, we could use as a predicate for the jurisdiction to mailing in a copy of the indictment to him because he should have anticipated we'd do that. Now, that's a stretch.
Well, it is.
So we never really advocated it. I wouldn't
push that far, but I do think.
But you're saying he was actually using the mails so that the courts wouldn't be savvy to him, that they would
at least
have an extra layer before they realized it was actually Mr. Seidling again.
It also allowed him to do it in a lot of counties. I think we have 10 counties that were covered by the counts in the indictment. I think it's more like 16 or 18 of the 44 in the Western District that are covered by all the relevant conduct. And it's not that hard to drive from Madison to Sawyer County and back and forth, but it's a lot easier if you just mail all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately why I don't think there's a policy that this court's decision should reflect, which is you've got to stop the government here. They're using 1341 once again to kind of push the envelope. Bottom line is I don't think I'm actually that creative, so I don't think I could think that deeply. This, to me, as it really is, looks like lies and misrepresentations to obtain property from the victims, and the lies are material because they had a tendency to influence and did influence the recipient of those lies. To me, that's straightforward federal mail fraud. With most mail frauds, there is some other state crime that could be prosecuted, but that is essentially, in my view, neither here nor there. So what we would ask the court to do is to make explicit what was at least somewhat implicit in the Cosentino case that we've all talked about, and to say that a scheme to obtain money under mail fraud property it requires misrepresentations, it requires the scheme, but there is no specific requirement that those misrepresentations tend to influence the ultimate victim. As the instruction said, it must be capable of influencing, as our instruction says, I should say, it must be capable of influencing the person or entity to whom it is made, but no specific requirement that that person be the actual victim. If there's any other questions, I'd love to answer them. But if not, I'm going to sit down.
I don't think so. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time? Well, you can probably go over the 30 seconds.
Well, maybe I can do it in that. Just a couple of observations. First of all, Mr. Wojcik, the person that testified at sentencing, I in evaluating both my client's response during sentencing to Mr. Wojcik, it is important for the court to check what I believe is docket number 50, which responds to Mr. Wojcik and details some of the recent history between my client and Mr. Wojcik, including the fact that Mr. Wojcik had recently failed to persuade the bankruptcy court in Florida to pursue certain claims against Mr. Seidling. So the animosity ran both directions between Mr. Wojcik and Mr. Seidling. The second thing is I know what the jury instructions says, I've read it. I actually tracked it while it was pending for approval. And the reality is that this specific issue that is brought before the court in this matter had not been addressed by this court at the time the jury instruction was drafted.
In order to fill a vacuum, you took the case.
Trying to help, Your Honor, as I always do. Implications aside from the state versus federal policy, the cartel example in Walters is now subject to prosecution under the government's theory. And something very close, which happened in Wisconsin a couple years ago, two political candidates, matter of fact, competing candidates for the Wisconsin Supreme Court, one advertises and mailed flyers misrepresenting the other candidate. Now, those misrepresentations were directed to the public, and now that type of behavior is subject to prosecution under 1341 under the government's theory. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the final case this morning, United States versus Panetta.